Osiris.
Hey everybody, this is the Helping Friendly Podcast. This is episode 140, we just figured out. Hey Jonathan.
Hey RJ.
Hey Matt.
Hey man, how's it going?
So good. We are a week away from summer tour and we're excited. The first thing I want to say is, if anyone listening is someone who obsesses over Phish set lists, or maybe has a long text chain going with their friends about Phish and Phish shows and Phish set lists, I don't know anyone like that. Jonathan, do you?
Like probably about 70% of my friend groups.
So you and I actually have both. We do both of those things. We obsess over set lists and we have a text chain about that. But that's why we are happy to partner with Lure Social, which is luresocial.com. They are creating a pretty cool digital community that's connecting fans with gaming experiences. It's basically, you know, you're competing against your friends and against us to guess what Phish will play on any given night. They'll be doing it this summer tour. You should sign up. I'm at RJHFpod. Jonathan is at.
I'm Road Jimmy.
Road Jimmy. That's surprising.
Yeah. And I don't want to brag or intimidate anyone, but I did call the Pigtail summer tour opener last year.
I think anyone who listens to this podcast already knew that, because I think it's come up on every episode since.
I have maybe mentioned it.
So you don't want to, you know, Jonathan's got the goods, but
I'm not saying that I'm going to do well this year. I'm just saying I had that one. And so I'm not really going to be trying anymore, because why bother?
Yeah. Also, like, they're not going to, you know, you're going to guess Pigtail again and, you know, they're not going to open with Pigtail again. So
I'm not guessing Pigtail again.
No one has to worry about it. What's the use was last summer. The last opener, last summer tour, and that seems to me to be incredibly difficult to predict. So maybe they'll throw us for a loop again this time. But I think, you know, before we get too far into guessing set lists, first of all, people, if you're not already signed up, go to luresocial.com, L-U-R-E social, and sign up and play against us and play against your friends. And you'll probably beat me. You might not be Ed Jonathan me. Or Matt.
No, but you'll beat me.
Jonathan, what are your summer tour plans?
Let's see. So for the Gorge, I'm going to celebrate, it's not the Gorge. Tahoe opens the tour, right?
Yeah.
Or is it the Gorge?
Tahoe.
Okay. Matt, fix that in the edit. Okay, yeah. So for the tour opener, I am going to have all my wisdom teeth removed.
Are you serious?
Because I'm in my 40s, and so now it's time to get all my wisdom teeth taken out on the day the tour begins. So I will be couch touring like a boss that weekend.
Jeez, really, man? Are you serious? Yeah, or are you just saying that? Because that sounds like the worst thing you could possibly do.
It's absolutely serious.
Holy shit. Yeah. Sorry, man. I keep saying I'm sorry, and my phone keeps thinking that I'm saying Siri. anyway, so Jonathan, that is horrible. But and then what are you gonna do? What Phish shows are you gonna see?
That's it, man. So I'm gonna probably try to do something else horrible the following weekend, and then all right up until Coventry. Not Coventry. Curveball begins with a C. Clearly, I'm already predicting things.
If we're going back to Coventry, man, things are not looking good. Although it'd probably be better than last time, weather wise and maybe music wise. So we're going to be, Jonathan and I and Matt and our whole crew, actually our whole Osiris crew. And before I get into this, I just want to remind you that we're part of the Osiris Podcast Network. We're a community of podcasts, events, experiences. We're doing all kinds of really cool stuff. Check out osirispod.com to see some of the podcasts that are on our network and to hear about what we're up to. I'm going to tell you about what we're going to be up to this summer in a second, but I will say that the Relics Audio Hour is, I think, our most recently added podcast. They just launched a couple weeks ago, and their second episode I just listened to the other day was Don Waz being interviewed at the Brooklyn Bowl at the Relics Music Conference, which I was at, but I didn't get to see that interview. So that was kind of cool to see see that. You guys should check out that podcast. Jonathan, is there anything on the network you've been listening to?
I've plugged this a bunch of times on my my other podcast, but I really, Your other really podcast like,
that will not be named.
Yeah, I really, really like Welcome to the Party, Pal, which is one of the Across the Margin podcasts, but it's about TV and movies and stuff. And those guys, I just like listening to them break down shows. And I agree with many of their opinions. And yeah, it's a good show.
Cool. Yeah, there's so much good stuff going on. So people should go sign up for the newsletter if you want to learn what else we're up to. One thing we're going to be doing, as usual, Jonathan, Matt, and Brad and I will be hard at work on summer tour doing quick hits and trying to get those out as soon as we can after the shows the next day. But we're going to try something new as well that we're calling Osiris Live. And we're going to do some live streamed discussions and commentary before Phish shows, at set break, and after Phish shows. Sort of an experiment. We're going to see how it goes, but we encourage people to check it out. I think the best way to stay tuned is by subscribing to the Osiris YouTube page, which I will link in the show notes. And Tom and I will be kicking it off with a live stream discussion before Phish goes on stage at the Gorge on Saturday, July 21st. And I think Jonathan will join me, hopefully, for another one later on in the tour, right? And we will do things.
Yeah, I'm kind of excited. What were we talking about? We were talking about on August, whatever Jerry's birthday is, I think, is when I was going to try to crash your house and watch a show with you.
Yeah, and we're going to bring some, you know, the live commentary before show. We won't interrupt your Phish watching or streaming experience, obviously, but before, you know, set break, after, we'll give some commentary, some analysis, and maybe call in some special guests.
It's very important to note we won't interrupt the Phish show. In fact, I will not be allowing RJ to speak during the music.
We will not do that.
Absolute silence.
So this is going to be really fun. And again, it's an experiment. We want to hear people's feedback, but we'll put a link to the Osiris YouTube page. And it's also going to, a lot of this is going to be streamed through Relics as well. So check out their social media as well. Before we get into our interview for today, which is with Taylor Swope, a woman who founded this really cool company called littlehippie.com, and you'll hear my interview with her and a lot more about her. She has really cool tour stories and stories about life on the road, being a vendor, and how she turned that into a business, which I found really fascinating when I talked to her in New York a couple weeks ago. Jonathan, there were a couple shows recently, the Trey Trio, which I think it's still called the Trey Trio, even though technically it was a quartet, or is it called the Trey Quartet?
They were booked as the Trey Trio, and then this guy, Ray, decided to show up.
Heard about that guy.
Yeah. I watched the Levitation Fest stream, and that was really good. It was good, you know, Trey band rock show.
Yeah, I saw a little bit of that, too, and they looked really comfortable. He, you know, we heard from, I don't think those are up on Live Phish yet. They should be. If I had my druthers, I'd be listening to them. But so Matt, you were at the Charlottesville show, the Trey Trio / Quartet. I know you had some thoughts. We haven't heard it yet because it's not up on Live Phish. I'm sure I could find it if I went to some places, but I haven't. So tell people about it if they haven't heard any of it.
Yeah, it was a good time. It was interesting because I was really pumped to see the trio. I think that's a pretty unique configuration, and I love the stuff that I heard from the April shows, but was, you know, obviously stoked to have Ray back in the fold, and that seemed to be kind of the theme of the night, and of the other stuff that I saw and heard from that weekend, the three shows that they played. Trey was obviously, he was just kind of beaming with gratitude for having Ray around. He mentioned him several times. He kind of got choked up at the beginning of the show, you know, noticeably, just to be standing on stage next to his friend. Ray was in a great mood all night, and Trey just kept kind of tossing to him for solos and stuff. He'd just say, "Hey, Ray, take it," you know, and let Ray take a cool solo in, you know, Farmhouse or something like that. So that was really awesome. The venue there in Charlottesville is really neat. I hadn't been there before. But it's literally like, if you're familiar with Charlottesville, you walk to the end of the downtown mall and it's just, it's right there. And it seems like it's just kind of like this sort of, you know, community park or something like that. And my understanding is that they have a lot of like free shows there throughout the summer and stuff like that. But it's just, it's really small. You know, there was only a couple thousand people there and the venue wasn't full. Super, super hot. It's this like big tent, kind of something like a mini version of like Darien, or if you know, Pier 6 in Baltimore, it's kind of like that. So a lot of people were kind of like hanging outside. There was a funny part in the first set where they played a bunch of kind of scorchers in a row to open up the show. And then, they played Miss You. And I swear, like, maybe like 75% of the people that were in the pavilion left the pavilion at that point, to, you know, go and, you know, everybody kind of needed a beer or needed to hit the bathroom or something at that point. But I think most people were just hot and wanted to get out from the pavilion and took a breather. So it was funny cause I was standing with, Kate and Jeremy, friends of the show. Mm-hmm. And we kind of looked around and we went from being like surrounded by people to it just being completely empty. And we could have just walked right up to the stage at that point. But really a great show. The second set in particular had several awesome jams. The Soul Planet was really great. The Ghost was really great. You know, a little bit more straightforward, of course, than Fish, but also a little bit more outside playing than you'd expect from a Trey show. I think not having the horns allows them a little bit more flexibility to do some of that and kind of take the band in different directions. So it was really fun, and I don't know, it just mostly got me excited for summer tour.
Right on. And then they went to Central Park, and I think that was a really important, and I think Trey was pretty emotional throughout those shows because Ray was back and he's been very contemplative recently. So I'm going to listen back to those shows.
Yeah, I think the Twitter sphere reported good things from New York.
And then they played the Levitation Festival on the Cape, right?
I honestly don't know where that is.
I think it was on the Cape in Massachusetts, okay. Which, yeah, they streamed live and seemed to be having a good time. But, you know, I think Trey is probably excited to play with the Fish as we are excited to see the Fish.
Very excited to see the Fish, even though it's like forever away for me.
It is. It is not so far away from me. In fact,
this is where RJ rubs it in that he's going to go travel and see a Fish rock band.
Well, I already made a mistake, so I was going to say 24, and I don't know where that was going. But 1 week from today, I'll be at Tahoe watching the Fish, which is going to be super awesome, I think.
That sounds fun.
But, you know, tour opener, probably be lame, etc. So it'll probably be boring and I'll be sad. Too many repeats.
It's totally possible.
You know? But one thing about the Trey Trio show from Central Park, Tom Marshall, he sent me a photo of him with Scott Rogowski from HQ Trivia. And I think they met there. And I just want to say, Scott, if you listen to the Helping Friendly podcast, hello. Thanks for making a cool trivia game. And we are fans of what you do. Jonathan.
Anything, yes, RJ.
Anything else about summer tour? You never asked me which shows I was going to, but.
Well, I thought you were going to volunteer that. I obviously I've never interviewed anyone before. RJ, are you going to see any Fish shows this year?
Oh, thank you for asking. I am. I'm going next week to Tahoe and then I'm going to San Francisco as well, and then I'm going to Curveball, and I might fit in a Meriwether Post Pavilion show in between. So I feel very fortunate and excited that I get to see a lot of Fish shows. And Tahoe next Tuesday or Wednesday, I think Tom and I are going to try to do a little bit of this Osiris Live piloting from the parking lot, maybe just on YouTube Live. So again, you know, check us out on the Osiris YouTube page. I'll link to that. And you might see us talking about Fish in real time, which would be fascinating.
Well, one would hope it'll be fascinating.
No pressure.
No pressure at all.
So I guess we should get into this interview with Taylor. As I said, she's the founder of littlehippie.com. We were introduced to her by Stacy from Stranger Stopping Strangers. another Osiris podcast, and we got talking about stuff, and she has a pretty cool fish story, so we wanted to share that with you along with some music. So I don't know, Jonathan, anything else, or should we get to the interview?
Well, we should remind people, in case they don't already know, although I don't know how, because it seems like we always remind them, that you can find us at HFPod on Twitter and HFPod.com on the internet. And, you know, that is such a nice little URL. I should get one of those.
You should get one.
But, and then, I don't know wherever else we can, you can find. We're on the Facebooks, and people should find us on those things, and they should review us on all the their favorite podcast source, whether it be Stitcher or iTunes or the Google things or whatever.
So just Spotify.
Like Spotify, if that's your thing. Put in the stars and the thumbs ups and what have you, so that other people who have good taste like yourselves will be able to find the show.
Yeah, well, you guys give us many stars. Give us many stars. And mostly because Jonathan has a really nice beard and Matt does great editing and Brad's funny. And so just for those reasons, please give us stars. And I think we'll get into the interview. Should we do it, Jonathan?
Do it.
All right. And thank you, everyone who has reviewed recently. We appreciate that. We've seen them coming in. We love all you guys. And thanks for listening. And enjoy this conversation with Taylor. Stay safe out there on the road. And we'll see you for some quick hits pretty soon. Keep on rocking. All right. Hey, everyone. I'm here with Taylor Swope from littlehippie.com. Hi, Taylor.
Hi. How's it going?
It's going great. We are here in New York on what is, I think, the hottest
day. At least the hottest day of the year so far.
So far. It's like immediately melting when you walk outside. You're based in Bushwick, Brooklyn?
Correct.
And I know you've lived on the East Coast for most of your life, but we'll talk a little bit about your website and company, littlehippie.com, which is really cool, and I want our listeners to hear more about it. And I think we were introduced originally by Stacy.
Right, from Stranger Stopping Strangers.
Yeah, from another Osiris podcast, so, you know, the network is strong. So, yeah, I guess before we get into the sort of business aspect of what you're up to, tell us a little bit about how you got into music, how you got into fish, and maybe some of your first memories.
Okay, I can do that. Fish and I didn't get along at first. It took me a long time to get into fish. I was aware of fish for years before I even listened to them. I think, you know, at first I remember seeing the Hoist tape in one of my friend's bedrooms when I was younger and just kind of being like, what is that, you know? And
it's a weird album cover.
It is a weird album cover for sure. I think it even like freaked me out a little bit. And then,
and you're from the Northeast, so fish was probably like...
Everywhere. Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're talking, you know, I guess late 80s when I probably first, or early 90s, I don't even know when it came out. But, and then, you know, I grew up on the shoreline in Connecticut with a group of friends that we'd all sneak out at night in the summer and listen to music. And that was one of the friends who I did that with. He's the one who had that fish tape, but I don't really remember listening to it, but I remember getting into classic rock and the Dead and all that stuff. And I moved to San Diego for 8th and 9th grade and started sending mixtapes back and forth to friends and writing letters and, you know, very analog. And someone sent me a tape that said, you should check out The Grateful Dead. And it was basically just like a mashup of Skeletons in the Closet and American Beauty. It wasn't very original.
Yeah.
It was like,
yeah.
You know, the obvious hits. And so I started listening to The Grateful Dead while I was out there, and my first concert, at least the first one I really remember, was I went to see the Jerry Garcia Band for my 15th birthday at the San Diego Sports Arena.
Wow.
Yeah. And my parents took me and a couple of friends, and they were very, I don't know, nice, I guess, to let us go do our own thing, but they went up to the higher seats where they could supervise us down on the floor. So I don't know how much they could actually see us, but they were definitely trying to keep an eye on us.
Were they interested in the music too?
Not at all.
No.
Not at all.
They were actually there to supervise.
Yeah, and you know, as much as they were never into the same things that I was, they've always been really supportive of the fact that I wanted to follow these interests. So they were a little scared of it back then. They were scared of a lot of things I was doing back then, just growing up as a teenager, you know. But yeah, they were cool about it to take me. And so that's actually the only time I got to see Jerry Garcia.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because that was, I guess, 93. Yeah. And then I had a ticket to the last Highgate show, but it was the morning or the night before high school graduation. And at the last minute, my mom was like, "You're not driving all the way up there and trying to come back for graduation."
So was that was part of the last tour?
Yeah, it was like one of the last shows. Yeah, it was the one where, you know, some kid got struck by lightning in a tree and the gates were crashed and, you know, it was a disaster. So it's probably okay that I didn't go. And my friends that I was supposed to go with, they all lost each other. Yeah. They definitely didn't make it back in time the next day. And it wasn't actually, I was a junior. I wasn't my graduation. It was their graduation. Okay. So it didn't really matter. But so... So, yeah, so that was the only time I got to see Jerry Garcia, and, but, you know, I don't really remember the concert, I'll be honest, but I remember just being sort of overwhelmed by all of it, and I remember Set Break the best, because I just remember sitting on the floor with my two friends, just kind of wondering, like, what were we supposed to do with ourselves? What was everyone doing? And what? And obviously, we were young, you know, so we stood out a bit, and we just, we just didn't know what to do with ourselves, and, so I, you know, I think I've gone back and listened to the show. I can't really remember, but so that was my first live concert experience, and then I moved back to Connecticut shortly thereafter, and I can't really remember going to a whole lot of concerts in high school. I remember I went to see the Rolling Stones at Giant Stadium. Maybe when I was like 17 or something, and we were way up at the top, and I don't remember enjoying that very much either, because it was just like such a to-do, you know, it was so long, took so long to get there, and it was such a big show, and you couldn't see the stage, and it didn't do anything for me at all, you know, it was one of those where it was like cool to say we went to it, but I think the first time I remember really like loving the experience of going to a show with my friends was I went to see Tom Petty at one of the venues in New Haven for my, it must have been my 16th birthday, 16th or 17th birthday. And so I got to drive.
Wow.
And I remember like that feeling of like, getting to drive myself to a concert. And that was pretty cool. And I think it was the Palace in New Haven. I don't think it's not there anymore. But
was that during Wildflowers or was that before Wildflowers?
I want to say it was. I looked it up at some point recently because I was curious what it was that I got to see. And I remember going to see Bob Dylan there in high school at a friend who we were both.
So you were always like, sounds like you were going to a lot of shows.
I mean, I was always interested. Yeah. I wasn't really allowed to do a lot. Like, New Haven was this, like, forbidden place that I wasn't supposed to go to, you know, so I had to get special permission to go out and see Tom Petty and Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was always trying to. I was always interested in going to see music. And then I actually left high school after my junior year, so I went to college when I was 17. So I, you know, pretty quickly then was able to go and do whatever I wanted to do. So... that's when I went to my first Phish concert, was Lake Placid. So it would have been like 96, maybe October or something.
Yeah. 96, yeah. October 96. That was like the fall 96 tour. I think started up there, like Buffalo, Lake Placid in like mid October before Halloween.
Yeah. That sounds right. I remember like knowing that it was the beginning of the tour.
Yeah.
So I went up with, a few girls that I had become friends with in the dorms and stuff. And I think it must have been my sophomore year because I had a car and I drove us and I didn't have a car my freshman year. So, and again, like I didn't really get it. I didn't really know what I was supposed to be doing. And I think I lost my friends pretty early on and, or wasn't really trying that hard to stay with them.
Yeah.
I remember they'd made a bunch of hemp necklaces to sell and I didn't like hemp necklaces.
I think I bought one of them from them like that year or the year before.
Really? I just never understood the hemp necklace thing.
Yeah, no, they're pretty dirty, but people love them. So it's funny because I think a lot of fans who follow, you know, all the shows and all the tours would say that like that fall of 96 before Halloween was like just okay. Like they weren't,
it wasn't a
great part. I mean, once they hit Halloween and then, you know, covered the Talking Heads and all that, like then their playing started to change. And I think like maybe those like 2 weeks, which I saw them a little bit after that, but Maybe that's why. Maybe the playing just didn't like strike you.
I feel like that's definitely possible because I think I would have. I just think I would have known if it was good. You know, even though I wasn't really into it, I think I would have had like, I would have been more aware of. I don't know. I would have connected with it more. You know.
Well, lest we be fact checked by our audience, you did see the first night of the fall tour.
Oh, I did.
They opened the fall tour in Lake Placid, and then went to State College, and then Pittsburgh, and then Buffalo.
Okay. The opening night maybe not so great.
Yeah. I think those are fun shows to go back to because they had a lot of new material at that time. A lot of stuff from Billy Breathes was sort of new, but yeah, not like crazy playing.
Yeah.
When do you remember first like being at a Phish show and being like, oh, this is awesome? Did it take a while?
It did take a while. So I went to a couple of more. So I ended up leaving that one at some point, I think in the second set or maybe even during set break and just like wandering around outside in the cold and like Placid looking for something to eat. Like I got outside and I was like, well, this isn't better. I don't know why I just left. You know, I was just, like I said, I just didn't know what to do with myself.
No drugs.
No.
Okay.
No. And
otherwise that would make a lot of sense.
No drugs. No, generally my whole concert history is pretty drug free. Yeah. Like I'm a pretty sober person. Yeah. So, of the weird decisions I've made have been my own.
For better or worse.
Yeah, I can't really blame them on anything.
Yeah, yeah.
But so then the next time I saw Phish was a few months later. I actually saw them at the Bataclan in Paris because I went to Paris for school.
Whoa.
Yeah, so that was cool. And again, I didn't really know the music yet, but I do remember having fun at that show.
That's amazing.
That was pretty cool.
That was that was like February 97
mm-hmm.
when they were on that little Europe tour. Wow.
Yeah.
Really cool.
And so, yeah, so I would have, I went with a friend and yeah, it was just, I don't know, we just had fun. We knew it was something special. We knew like, even if we weren't super into the music or really knew what the music was, we knew we were lucky to be there and that goes a long way,
right?
Yeah,
totally.
And then I saw them, so that was, what, 97? So then we've got, like, a big gap.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next time I saw them was the fall of 2000?
Okay.
Which is right before they broke up the first time, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So fall of 2000, I was out in California, in Southern California, for, like, a month or so. I was trying to move to L.A. I'd been promised this job, and it didn't really manifest.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process, I ended up, that's how where I got exposed to the whole jam band thing, the festival world, and really randomly met some guys that were traveling with The Slip, and they took me to a show and started telling me about the Wetlands and told me about all this stuff, and I was kind of like saw my world get cracked open a bit.
Interesting. So, in California.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Guys from here.
Yeah.
And so then they convinced me to go to the Irvine show that fall, and again I was like, what is this? Like I just didn't like it, you know. And I left again, like during the second set.
And by that time, were you more into the Dead? And
I had always been into the Dead.
Okay, so yeah. So this was just like a Dead fan, sort of like not yet getting into Phish.
Yeah. And I'd been into music, and Bob Dylan was like huge for me growing up, Velvet Underground, all this kind of stuff, and the Dead was always a part of that. But yeah, I just didn't make the jump to Phish, you know. So, and that show was terrible by all accounts. That was not a good show. And
so you saw like early fall 96, late fall 2000. So you were like
bit of a strikeout, right?
Although the Europe 97 is pretty cool. That's like a rare gem.
And the weird thing too is that my least favorite song in this. I don't know if it's chicken or the egg. Like, did I hate the song already, or is it because of this experience? But my least favorite song is Wolfman's Brother.
Oh, man.
And it was played at all three of those first shows that I went to. And I'm pretty sure that, I don't remember from Paris. I know I didn't leave the Paris show, but I'm pretty sure that that's what drove me to leave both the Lake Placid and the Irvine shows. Right?
Well, according to Phish.net, the show that you saw in Irvine is 3.4 out of 5, which is near the... That's like
the nadir.
The bottom, yeah, exactly. The bottom quartile or something of Phish shows, which is too bad because that I think that tour is like not well looked upon.
Yeah.
But so then jumping forward, so you
okay? So then I don't see Phish again. Now we have another big gap. But in that time, I start going to lots of concerts because now I've been exposed to this. I come home from LA, I start going to the Wetlands like every weekend. And of course, the Wetlands closes about a year later. Yeah. So I was there for like the end of it, but I went all the time and kind of went to all events, started going to festivals. And then I ended up on like Widespread Panic Tour. Uh-huh. That was probably my first like going on tour. It was Panic in the South and, and some String Cheese and, whatever the Dead was at the time. Yeah. It was like around the time Joan Osborne was in the band, you know, and so it wasn't until, the New Year show in Miami going into 2004.
Yep.
That's when Fish, I fell in love. Uh-huh. Like that was it. The night of the Blue Bunnies.
Nice.
It just hit me. Like I was like, this is amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. It really was. It was the New Year's time. You know, it was Jungle Boogie. Yeah, it was everything.
Yeah.
It was the Mini Cooper and the marching band and all of it. And I was with someone who's now one of my best friends, but we had just met, and he yanked me like past the security guards onto the floor.
Nice.
And, you know, all of a sudden it's like balloons and glitter and everything all over and people bumping into us, dancing. Yeah. And I was just like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then didn't they break up? Like,
My
timing was
later,
pretty off.
Yeah. So you're like, you keep seeing them right before they break up.
Yeah. So I saw a bunch of them in 2004.
Yeah.
And I was at Coventry. And,
same here.
And that was, I actually didn't even really see much of the shows at Coventry. I was working and trying to run two booths, and one of the booths was just sinking straight into the mud.
Yeah, the mud was the, you know, the music and all that, like the whole experience was subpar, but the, man, the mud.
The mud.
I lost shoes. People were losing shoes. I mean, for people who weren't there, I mean, it's hard to explain that, like, if you walked into the mud, like, it was hard to get out.
Literally.
It was not just the drugs or whatever, as Taylor can attest to, because she was mostly sober.
Right.
It was actually the mud.
Yeah. So my friend who I was just talking about, who yanked me onto the floor for Jungle Boogie, he sells sandals, and he just had a mountain of, like, broken shoes in front of his booth at the end. Like, he has no other weekend that compares. And we've done a lot of money festivals together, but that one stands out, you know.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It's funny, because I think we're around the same age, and I started seeing a lot more shows during the, like, 2001 to 2009 period, like, in general, you know, when Fish wasn't playing. And probably, like, got into, as you were describing, like, more live music at that time, just because there was not any Fish to see. So I saw lots of other stuff.
You know? Yeah, well, there was this kind of void because there was no really big band leading the charge. Mm-hmm. It was a great like window for all these smaller bands to have moments. And Bonnaroo hadn't started yet. And it was like, or it was, you know, I guess just starting towards the latter half of that period. But it was this like kind of golden age of smaller bands having an opportunity to reach a larger audience than they would have been able to otherwise. And it was a lot of fun, you know, and it was also definitely before like electronic music came into the festival scene.
Yeah.
And so, there were so many bands then that I remember just being so excited about. I don't know, I probably can't even tell you half of them now.
I was talking to a friend who I met earlier today about Deep Banana Blackout, which was a band that I saw a bunch of times, and he mentioned them, and I like hadn't thought about that band forever because there's like dozens of bands.
It's a really good example of one of those. Yeah, the recipe that came up in conversation with someone a couple days ago. You know,
all fun stuff.
Leftover Salmon, bands like that.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know if they could have held my attention forever, but it was a fun moment, right?
Yeah. So during that time, at some point during that time, you started your business, right?
I did, yeah.
So tell us how that started. Obviously, people can find you now at littlehippie.com, but did it start as an e-commerce thing, or did it start as a festival thing, or was it both, or how did it come together?
It didn't start as e-commerce, but that wasn't long after. It started in parking lots. It started before Little Hippie with selling, the first thing I sold was food, but it wasn't my thing. I was with someone who had been selling food for a while, and so I ended up going on tour with him and learning the ins and outs of how to show up in a parking lot, how to find a spot, how to, you know, what venues work, what venues don't, which ones are worth going out of the way for and which ones are worth taking the day off for and all that stuff, and how to play cat and mouse with the local authorities.
Which I think is like that whole thing is like an undertold story of live music.
Yeah.
You know, like everyone just shows up and the shakedown is set up.
Yeah.
And the food is there and the clothes are there, but I know there's like so much behind it.
Totally. Right? I mean, I brought a friend to Camden a couple weeks ago for the Denton Company who's been to tons of shows, and I just kind of on a whim was like, hey, you want to go with me to Camden? I'm going to go down early though. And, mm-hmm. and she said, what do you mean by early? I was like, no, like early, you know? Yeah, yeah. And we got there and she had literally never seen this before. You know, I don't know how many shows she's been to, but lots. Yeah. And she had, was just like, I had no idea that how this, what goes into this, yeah. you know? And it was a cool experience for her to get to see it, but she also had no interest in doing it again. She had a great day, and yeah. she was like, nope, that's it.
You so know? When you were learning all this stuff, did you know that you were learning it so that you could, like, figure something else on your own, or were you just kind of going with the flow and seeing what happens?
I was trying to survive, for mm-hmm. one thing. So I was pretty young, and it was right after 9/11, mm-hmm. and I had a series of, you know, kind of inconsequential jobs after yeah. college. I was hell-bent on being a photographer, but it was right at the time that photography was switching from film to digital, mm-hmm. and no one was taking digital seriously. Mm-hmm. But to try and become a photographer with film at the, you know, it was challenging because of the expense and also because it was obviously going out. Mm-hmm. And so it was just this strange time to try and do that. And I started going to festivals because I thought that I wanted to go to grad school and I needed a portfolio. And so I thought, well, I'll go and I'll take pictures of the crowds at festivals. Yep. That's a cool story for
makes
a portfolio.
Sense. Yeah, totally.
And I wanted to do editorial photography. So, you know, I was trying to kind of create a portfolio that could serve me either for grad school or to try and get work. And so, you know, photography for me was never about the bands on stage. It was about the crowds. It was about the story of why do people go to this? What brings them here? Why do they want to connect in this environment? And I really enjoyed that, but there wasn't really anything to do with it, you know? Yeah. And it was the summer before 9/11, and then 9/11 happened. And the weekend before 9/11 was when I met the guy that I mentioned, mm-hmm. and I brought him back to New York with me at the end of the weekend. We woke up Tuesday morning planning to leave. Couldn't get out of the city, yeah. had no choice but to stay. And then we left the next day, and I didn't come home for 3 months afterwards. So that was the first fall that I really went on tour. That was, like I said, panic. You know, I ended up down in the South, mm-hmm. and just went on this crazy adventure,
yeah.
kind of like, I'm just doing this for right now.
Yeah.
You know, there was no plan. Right. I was 23 years old, and I just had to do something. And I had a really cheap apartment. That was the mm-hmm. thing, is I got really lucky with this apartment that I had forever. And so I was able to just kind of leave it and go do this thing. And so, you know, we were making just enough to get to the next
yeah.
show. It wasn't like, you know, I think the only bill I had then was a cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it wasn't, yeah. there were no stakes really.
Right, right, right.
So, you know, I loved the excitement of learning this like underground world, and I loved everything about it. I wasn't doing it with the idea that I was going to build a business out of it. I just was doing it because it was an adventure. It was better than being in New York.
Mm-hmm.
It was something I thought was temporary. And I was pretty captivated by the person who was
yeah.
like, hey, let's go do this. Let's
yeah,
go do
yeah.
this. I'll show you this thing. I'll show you this, you know? And
yeah.
so I just went. I didn't
yeah.
think a whole lot about it, you know? So that gets us like through the first like few months, you know,
yeah.
and then that winter I come back, I'm home again, I come home for the holidays, and I took a Adobe Illustrator class at, I think Parsons, and
yeah.
they do like a January semester, right? So I went for like 4 weeks to learn Adobe Illustrator because I had in my head like, well, if I want to be a photographer, I've got to learn how to design a business card. Like it was that simple, right? I had really not a lot of thought. And so I started learning Adobe Illustrator, which was pretty simple still back
uh-huh.
then. And then I had a friend who designed websites. And so he came over and he showed me how to write HTML and we created a little portfolio for me.
Uh-huh.
And from there, I just started learning design. And so I had no idea that that's what I was going to do.
Interesting.
And so once I started learning design, I was like, well, now I can make things, you know,
yeah.
I can put this on something and
yeah.
someone will buy it. And so
people did,
which still blows my mind,
yeah.
you know, and especially when I think back to the primitive, like how basic the things I first made were, I can't believe that people bought them and that I got to keep doing it and get that I was given the opportunity to get better
yeah.
was pretty remarkable.
Yeah. And you, I mean, what you have now on your site, I mean, is there's so much stuff, and I assume it's not just you that's designing everything.
It's mostly me.
Is it really?
Yeah, it is mostly me. There's amazing. A few pieces of art that are collaborations. There's, I think, one piece of art, that one that you were just looking mm-hmm. at. Mm-hmm. That was done by another girl who worked for me for a bunch of years. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's mostly me. I do all the web design for it. I worked with a programmer for a few years, for about 4 years. Now it's been a couple of years since we worked together, but it was a different site than the one you're looking at. And, he taught me development. Like mm-hmm. My friend way back when taught me HTML, which was all you needed back mm-hmm. then, you know, like maybe some JavaScript. Mm-hmm. And then the site that I had for like 10 years had gotten to the point where it was just terrible and like no one was using it, and to upgrade to do updates on it was going to be really, it just wasn't worth it, you know? Mm-hmm. So I started from scratch with this guy who taught me like modern, like how people are actually developing now, you know? And I was able to then take that and run with it. I switched to Shopify a couple of years ago. So that's what you're looking at.
So you started, I know that, you're like in the 15th or 16th year now, and there's a lot to talk about. But did you start trying to make, it wasn't just for kids, but maybe kids became like a good area over time?
It gave me my own thing. So mm-hmm. kids came at about a year after I started going to shows, or after I started like going to shows to sell stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So the fall of 2002. So, you know, first there was food briefly, then started making some stuff, and started making stuff by going down to the wholesale district here in New York and buying second quality t-shirts that were all like pretty awful, you know, just men's t-shirts and making stuff with heat transfers. And then, we would do that. We'd have the grill set up in like half the tent. We'd have a handful of t-shirts, and just like bit by bit, we had more and more t-shirts. Wow. And, you know, every weekend I was less interested in the food and more interested in the apparel. And
awesome.
Especially once I saw people wearing my stuff. But what the stuff that we were making then wasn't really an expression of my interests. And I wasn't that interested in making stuff for men. And I still don't really, I make some stuff for men, but I don't really know how. I don't know what they want. You know?
Right, right.
It doesn't come naturally to me. And so, you know, I was in this kind of weird limbo where I was like, I like what I'm doing and I like making stuff, but I'm not making what I want to be making. And then that summer, I was just like one night I like woke up and like had in the middle of the night I was like a little hippie and I went back to sleep.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I don't know, it just popped in my head that summer, you know? And then so that fall I started making kids stuff, and I saw some kids shirts in the wholesale district, which, you know, prompted me to actually make them.
Okay.
And,
cool.
And you know, the blank industry has grown so much in this
mm-hmm.
time,
mm-hmm.
and like over the past 15 years, you know, like American Apparel had barely started back then. And
right. And by that you mean like large amounts of stuff that you can do things with.
Yeah. Stuff that you can print on. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I started to get anything that wasn't a men's t-shirt was kind of rare,
mm-hmm.
you know, especially in the wholesale district in New York, it was just men's t-shirts. You know, you really had to sort through to find like a women's t-shirt.
Okay.
So literally the first kids t-shirt I even saw, I was like, kid stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like it wasn't like I had been exposed to tons of it. It was just
right.
all of a sudden there it was. And yeah, it was this idea. So I made a really basic shirt that just said Little Hippie, and as soon as I had it for sale, like instantly, I was like, this is what I'm going to do. This is my thing, you know?
It's amazing to think about, because like we made t-shirts for HF Pod, and we just went on to a website and uploaded our logo,
mm-hmm.
and then like people started getting t-shirts in the mail.
Yeah,
like,
on demand, right? I do some of that now, too.
Not, but that's just not how it worked.
I never even could have imagined it back then.
Yeah, that's kind of amazing that's changed so much.
It really is. And, you know, and part of that has to do with Shopify, too, because, first of all, Shopify made it so easy to build a store. And also, they integrate with all those on-demand printers. So, you know, even if there's other great platforms for building stores, but if you want to integrate with third-party apps, like Squarespace, for example, doesn't use third-party apps. So you could build an on-demand product, but then you've got to go and manually enter the order on the on-demand platform why would you do that? I don't know why Squarespace is not connecting that, you know? But, so Shopify has created this environment where it's just so easy to make things, But the flip side is that's where the bootlegging is coming from, yeah, the ease of it.
So let's talk about licensing a little bit, because you, I noticed like on your website that it's prominent as that you kind of walk people through that, or you've sort of done that as a little bit of a side gig, right, to help people understand how to license.
But you're talking about the Learn About Licensing link there?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've been licensed by the Grateful Dead since 2004, which came about a year after I officially started the business. So I made those first kids shirts at the end of 2002. By January 2003, I had established founded the business officially. That's when I started the website. It was January 2003. And later, September 2003, that's when I was discovered, you could say, by the Grateful Dead.
But not in the good way of like discovering a new...
Well, they discovered in the put that away, you can't sell here's my card kind of way.
Got it.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, which the funny part of that story is that happened at Irvine.
Okay.
So, the same place where I was like, this, what is wrong with this band?
Yeah.
You know, I went back for the Dead in 2003 and. I was selling stuff there. And,
wow.
Yeah. And so, so then by February 2004, I had signed a license, and then, you know, that went on kind of quietly for a long time. And 2006, the band closed up shop, and meaning Grateful Dead Productions, they signed the 10-year deal with Rhino Records, and it was really quiet for the first 5-6 years of that Rhino deal. And then, the couple years or even just the year leading up to Fairly Well, all of a sudden it exploded. It went from being at one point where I was one of 9 licensees to around Fairly Well, there were about 100.
Wow.
And I think it's still around 100. Like, they've done a really good job, building that business and maintaining it. And you know, Rhino renewed their deal with Grateful Dead last year. And so they're going forward with it. And so
for people who don't know, so the licensing deal is, well, I'll oversimplify, and if this is wrong you can tell me, so you pay them money to use the logo on the most basic level, and it's good for them because they get a share of the revenue, obviously, but do they get to tell you what you can and can't use? Like, is there...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is
so
there, like,
everything
does it get down to color and all that stuff, or is it more just like the image?
Everything goes through them for approval.
Okay.
It's based more around the art and the product. So licenses are done by category. So, you know, people will come to me and be like, "Oh, I've got this great idea for something you could do. You should make whatever, hats or backpacks or lunchboxes or..."
Mm-hmm.
Those are all great ideas. I'm not licensed for any of those things.
I see.
And so... And it's
like a Grateful Dead lunchbox.
Who wouldn't? I don't know why no one is doing it. It seems like a little heavy could.
Yeah.
But licenses are typically split between hard goods and soft goods. And by split, I mean that they have different managers internally. So at Rhino, I don't know if this is the case right now, but typically you'd have a soft goods manager and a hard goods manager. And to cross over is very unusual.
Oh.
So for me, I'm soft goods. And
yeah,
so,
what's the difference? Oh, hard goods, like
so,
actual,
like if I wanted to add lunchbox.
Oh, like actual, like...
Yeah, like physical product. Yeah, like t-shirts
versus
a mug, for example, would be a hard good.
I thought you were saying like vinyl or CDs.
No,
or
music's
something.
A whole nother department.
Yeah, whole different world.
Yeah, whole different team. And and I have nothing to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, if I wanted to make keychains, that would be a whole different thing, you know? So...
it's really funny that that's how they separate
it
out.
It is,
like,
isn't it?
The texture or whatever. I mean, like the...
I can't say that I really know where that comes from other than just you gotta categorize things somehow to manage them, right?
Yeah.
So I started really simple with just kids and women's clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think within a year I added men's, and then within a couple of years I added blankets, which I was able to do because the people who had been the longtime blanket manufacturer or blanket licensee retired. They retired when it switched from GDP to Rhino.
Okay.
And so I picked up the blanket license, and actually I sell more blankets than anything else. Even though I'm known as a kids' clothes person,
the blankets are really cool.
Blankets are crazy for us. And so the Learn About Licensing thing that you were just asking me about on the website, I put that up relatively recently because I get so many emails from people who want to know how to become a licensee. And so after Fairly Well, I became really well known as a licensee, and people started sending me tons of emails. They wanted to know my story. How did I become a licensee? So I wrote that story, the story about the parking lot. And that's on the website. So then that started to get me a ton of traffic, and people, if they Googled Grateful Dead licensing, they found my story. They started asking me, well, how could they become one? So I wrote this FAQ to answer questions, because I can't answer. I just can't email.
And you're not trying to, like, I mean, it seems like you're not trying to keep people out of doing it themselves, right?
No, I mean, the truth is that most of the people that email me aren't going to become licensees. They have an idea, and you can't build a licensing business on an idea. You have to have an established business and then grow it with licensing. So, you know, I was really lucky to be able to get in there when I did with as little as I had at such a new, early stage of my business. And I don't want to discourage anyone else from trying to do the same. But the reality is that you have to be ready to make a pretty large commitment. Mm-hmm. You have to already be established in a market with a product that's not a bootleg.
Yeah.
And be able to say, hey, this is my demographic. I'm certain that they would like whatever it is. Let's say Grateful Dead for, sake of conversation. And submit a proposal with projections and guarantees and all that stuff, plus insurance and the willingness to deal with the protocols of licensing.
Yeah.
It's a real job. It goes from being fun in the parking lot to a real job. And so, the trade-off for me was I stopped having fun in a parking lot.
Yeah.
I went home and I had to build an online business and I had to build a wholesale business and I had to deal with all of these things. That it was a real job.
Yeah.
So there's resources on my website if you want to learn about licensing. There's ways to contact me, obviously, but, I'm happy to talk to people about licensing, but I think there's some basics to know before you even start that conversation.
Yeah. Well, it's cool. You have so much stuff on the site that I think is cool. As a father of young kids, just like the kids stuff, I think is really cool. And I know there's tons of stuff for the home and for adults and for everyone else. Have you ever explored fish licensing, or is that just a whole different world?
As far as I know, Fish doesn't do licensing.
At all?
I don't think so. I think they do everything in-house. I would love to do fish stuff, and people obviously always suggest that I should, but I don't think it's the same. I just don't think they've built that.
Yeah.
And which raises also another point, which is that, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, like all of these, I don't want to say younger bands because they're not that young anymore, but like these bands that were, say, a generation or two behind Fish that now have pretty entrenched fan bases, they should be building licensing. Like, they should be following the Grateful Dead model and build licensing for themselves.
That's a good point.
So after I wrote that FAQ, I wrote that really with the intention of trying to help out the individual people that wanted information. And then I realized, actually, this is information that these bands would really value, really benefit by learning. And so, I don't know if any of that will happen, but I think
there's some...
So I don't know what Fish, what they'll end up doing either.
Yeah.
They do such a good job with everything on their own.
Yeah, they handle it all.
Yeah.
Which is sort of their brand, They kind of deal with everything themselves.
I think they're so good. I look to them as an example.
Yeah.
And I watch what they do and learn from them. But
me too.
Part of me does... Part of me doesn't want to do Fish because... you only want to do what you love so much. And, Grateful Dead has not been easy. And there have been many times where I haven't been able to listen to Grateful Dead music because it hasn't been... it makes me unhappy to listen to it because I've had some really challenging times with Grateful Dead licensing.
Yeah, fair. Yep.
And so, Fish has never made me feel bad.
Yeah.
Fish is never... I mean, other than those first couple of shows that confused me, right. But Fish
sorry
is...
Sorry you had to see them in Paris in 1997.
Sorry.
No, but yeah, that makes sense. You want to keep your, job and your passion separate on some level.
Yeah, and even though it's so much overlap, it's like, I can go to a Fish show and I can see tons of friends and I can dance and I can not worry about anything. And I need that.
Yes. So let me ask you real quick before we talk about the book that I know you're writing. A lot of people listening probably have been to many shows and bought a shirt from a vendor that's like a logo with like a word in it or like some kind of reinterpretation of a band name or logo or whatever. What's like the line between, licensing and art? And is that line like completely blurry?
It's very blurry, and it's often completely flouted. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's something that happens, the example you just gave with, like, the logo, like, Glide with the Tide logo, right? Yeah. That's actually two copyright infringements. Uh-huh. Like, if the people from Tide had half a sense to go to a fish show, they could hand out infringements. Obviously, they're not going to do that, you know? But there's something that exists there with fan art that you don't want to overregulate.
Yeah.
Because it does so much to build the fan base, yeah, and to build goodwill with the fan base and the fun of trying to find those loopholes, yeah, and trying to, you know, people love those kinds of shirts, right? They, yeah, want the stuff that's like the more creative and kind of, you know.
Yeah. Like more a little bit one step removed. And we should say fan art Pete, who's a friend of mine who's done a great deal for the fish scene in, yeah, terms of bringing fan art into the community. And I think that he has his own perspective on, like, it's sort of one step removed from the band, but, mm-hmm, but still using, like, ideas, images, you know, whatever. I don't know. I don't know the lines, but I assume that
I don't think anyone really does. Yeah. And I think that some of them that have been established could be enforced and aren't. Like, the donut, for example, the, you know, the red circle on, yeah, blue, that's trademarked, but it's everywhere, you know, and I don't know how, like, it would have to be the most exact red circle on blue to, yeah, enforce that, but, yeah, still, it is trademarked.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you go to any fish show, you're going to
see it everywhere.
Yeah, it's, yeah, everywhere, right? So, and even, like, I made a shirt recently that's four emojis, which, you know, I just made it for the fun of it for fan art last, uh-huh, winter over New Year's. And it's the cactus, the, yeah, circle, and the red guitar, uh-huh, and the keys.
Uh-huh.
And I think technically that's an emoji infraction, you know, like emoji. Right. Emoji is a intellectual property, yeah, that, like, you have to get licensing, right, for, right? Right. So, but yeah, I mean, fan art, I think, is a really interesting area because it is creative, for one thing. When you have to work around rules, you're forced to get creative.
Yeah.
And some people are really good at it.
Yeah.
Some people are terrible at it.
Yeah.
And some people are blatantly infringing. And,
yeah,
so I think that it is important to keep, like, some level of regulation there. And, I mean, Fish, I think, does a great job of riding that line.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah, because the fan art is obviously a huge part of the community and the scene, you know,
yeah,
and inspiring artists to do things.
And there are plenty of people who, they don't want official stuff.
Yeah.
They don't want the licensed stuff. They think of it as, like, too corporate or,
yeah,
whatever, you know,
yeah,
like, and, they only want lot shirts.
Yeah.
And so there, you know, there's gotta be something for everyone. And there's also something to be said for, like, for example, right now, like, Den Company isn't selling kids' clothes at the shows. The official merchandising booth does not have kids' clothes, which is absolute insanity to me.
Mm-hmm.
People want kids' clothes.
Yep.
What am I going to do? Not sell them kids' clothes at a Den Company show?
You know, right,
like,
right.
I mean, my stuff's licensed, but,
yeah,
like, if they aren't going to take it upon themselves to make it for the family, like, the laws of supply and demand, someone's going to fill that gap,
right? Yeah,
so,
totally. Yeah, I mean, yeah, kids, you know, especially in our, like, fan bases, there's a lot of parents of young kids, you,
yeah,
know, or young or older kids generally.
Yeah.
So if you're a licensee, does that mean that, like, someone comes by and, like, checks your license at, like, a booth, or is it more complicated than that?
It can happen. I haven't been doing lot stuff for,
yeah,
years, so I don't know a whole lot about what goes on out there.
Yeah.
This last Dead and Company tour is the first time that I've gone out and sold stuff in a parking lot in a long time. And I haven't encountered any of that, but I have my contract with me. And everything I have says has the copyright on it. All of my art says copyright.
So, like,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I suppose somebody could just print that. They
right.
really, you know,
right,
but,
right, right.
But, you know, I have the legal line on everything because that's one of the requirements of licensing is
uh-huh.
that you put it on there. So, you know, I think people definitely do get stuff confiscated. I know that people have gotten stuff confiscated on this tour, and it happens everywhere. I got
yeah.
stuff confiscated at Coventry because it said Coventry. I thought I was in the safe zone with the town name,
yeah.
but they had a temporary injunction against... They do that whenever they can, you know? So you can't think you're safe by using a town name because they... If it's...
Good to know.
Yeah.
Good
if
to
it's
know.
The name of the event,
yeah.
then it's, you know...
Then it's part,
yeah.
of, the, it's part of the deal. So I know that, Taylor, you're in the process of writing a book.
Yes.
About Did you just give the whole book away in this conversation?
No, I was conscious not to.
What inspired you to write a book, and can you tell people a little bit about what it?
Yes.
Sort of what it's about.
So the book has been written. I'm now in the editing phase, and I just spent the last year and a half or so in near isolation writing it.
Amazing.
And it was a very, very intense process. So, I mean, it's one of those where, like, I did a lot of these things because I wanted to live a life worth writing about, like that old trope, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I grew up wanting to be a writer. I didn't grow up wanting to be an artist.
Yeah.
And I started writing in third grade. I've been journaling since third grade. And so with moving around as a kid, I started writing letters. I saved all of that. I have all my old journals,
wow.
all my old letters,
wow.
all my old emails when I started emailing. Like, I saved everything. So the process...
Are they in, like, boxes?
My mom doesn't really appreciate this habit.
There's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, but part of writing this is I'm like, I think I'm gonna get rid of a lot of stuff when this is finally done. But I had to research my own life, which was a little bit weird, right? To go back. So the book is, you know, my experience with all of this stuff, my experience with licensing, and it's a memoir, but it's also a bit of a business book without being a business book. It's not like a how to get rich and be hugely successful, because that's not something I've done. So I can't write that book, you know.
How to become ridiculously wealthy selling awesome Grateful Dead t-shirts.
That's not this book. You know?
I think it's a good idea.
Well, if I accomplish it someday, I'll write that book. But
that makes sense. I mean, sharing your... what you've learned.
Yeah, right? So it's a mix of, you know, insights into business and insights into being an independent woman on the road.
Yeah.
That's a very unique experience.
Yeah.
Most of the people who are out there doing this are men.
Yeah.
And when I first started, if I knew any woman who was on the road, she was with a man, myself included.
Yeah.
You know, so the first thing I had to do was end that.
Yeah.
And go out on my own.
Yeah.
And that was big to do that, you know, and I still don't see very many women out there on their own, you know, so it's about, you know, all of that stuff, right? But also with some insight into, like, well, if you want to live a creative life and you want to start a business and your goals are about personal satisfaction and, you know, not necessarily about getting rich and famous, you can do those things, you know, so... Hopefully it'll inspire some people to pursue their dreams. You know?
When will it be, like, done, out? Is there any...
I'm at the next phase. I'm going to do one more draft. I'm going to probably in July, I've got like a window, like 2 or 3 weeks where I can go hibernate and do another round of edits.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to start pitching it. So, you know, I have enough of a built-in audience that I could self-publish, but I really want to do it traditionally if I can, but I haven't started pitching it. So I have some agent referrals, and my next thing is to, like, start pitching agents and see what happens. But I'm hoping, like, within a year.
Awesome.
You know, that's my goal.
If anyone listening, you know, works for a publishing company or is a publisher, get in touch.
Yeah, or an agent.
Or an agent. Yeah. Any of the above, anyone who is interested in books. So this episode is going to come out right before the Fishes summer tour. I know you'll be on the road for a lot of the summer, or at least pieces of the summer. Where can people find you? Of course, they can find you on the internet at any time.
Yeah, so littlehippie.com or littlehippie.com anytime. Any social media is either littlehippie LLC or I'm Taylor Swope Art. In person, they can find me. I think I'm going to go to the Camden Fish shows. I'm probably going to go to Curveball, maybe the Gorge. And I think that's about it. I have to do some hibernating. I got to finish the book.
Yeah,
so
finish the book.
It's all balance. Yeah.
The Gorge, from what I hear, is worth the trip. But
I've been to the Gorge many times.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Oh, I love it. Yeah. Okay. And I wanted to go for Dead and Company, but it's too much for one night, you know.
Amazing. Well, this is really cool, and the business that you've built is really awesome, and I'd encourage people to check it out, and thanks for spending time with us and sharing your story.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for hearing it.
Cool. So, Taylor, I think on the way out of this episode, on the back end, maybe we'll play a little bit of that show that you were forced to go to in Paris in February of 97.
That sounds good. I would like to hear it, actually.
So we'll play a little bit of that, and thanks everyone for listening, and you can find us obviously on the internet, hfpod.com. Get in touch with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, whatever whatever your platform of choice is. And thanks, Taylor, again for coming on.
My pleasure.
Starts to rot. Maybe so, maybe not. This podcast is In the Loop, the Legion of Osiris podcasts. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with live experiences and podcasts about artists and topics you love. Get in the loop at osirispod.com.